Welcome to TWiL, the Week in Health Lore, the over-the-counter podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on November 18th, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis. My co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the University of Maryland School of Law in Baltimore, Maryland.
Today we welcome Nicholson Price. Professor Price is professor of law at the University of New Hampshire School of Law, where he researches and teaches intellectual property, innovation policy, health law, and the life sciences. Welcome, Nicholson.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here.
Great. Well, before tackling the bleeding edge of intellectual property and life sciences, we both have some stuff that needs moving off our desks. And I'm going to start with a case that has had several TWiL mentions. It's almost a TWiL regular. It's called In Re Lab MD, and it's an FTC case. Over the last week, we've had a 92-page opinion, the latest installment in the Lab MD saga, by an administrative law judge. And some of the blog and newspaper headlines describe this in really quite strong terms. So, for example, I read, administrative judge dismisses FTC case against LabMD in a ruling that could reshape future FTC enforcement authority. Another one, FTC's data security authority limited in the LabMD ruling. And my favorite, I think, it was a double whammy. FTC blasted in LabMD data security case, a stunning defeat. So I thought I'd unpack that a little bit and see just how stunning the defeat was. On the facts, and it's important to remember this was on the facts, the administrative law judge held that the FTC had failed to prove that any sort of limited exposure to this allegedly exposed file of health information was not a meaningful exposure. It had not and likely would not cause any tangible injury. And there was insufficient evidence that this alleged cyber breach led to some of the material in this file being out there in the real world. The judge held that the FTC had proved a possibility of this injury, but not the probability of harm. And so on the facts, kick the case. I think restricting this concept of substantial injury, which comes to us courtesy of the Federal Trade Commission Act, Section 5N, restricting that idea of substantial injury as not including emotional or subjective harm, or in some senses future injury, is something that would be a bit troubling to FTC. It's also reminiscent of some of the Article 3 standing issue cases dealing with class actions brought over cyber breaches that also have been discussed here on TWiL. However, I think calling this a stunning defeat, and incidentally, it's an appealable one, even if it's stunning, for the FTC may be something of an exaggeration. Maybe just a blip in what Dan Solov and Woodrow Hartzog have called the FTC's new common law of privacy. And the two pieces, I guess, that I would stress providing this counter-narrative is that the more important health data protection issues that LabMD had protested earlier in the litigation were not in any way upset here. First, the FTC's jurisdiction in privacy and security matters is in no way limited by the existence of a domain-specific regulatory model. At issue here was HIPAA. LabMD saying this is, if anything, governed by HIPAA, so FTC shouldn't be coming in. FTC pushed back on that early, and that wasn't affected in this ALJ decision. Secondly, the other early contentious issue in LabMD was whether Section 5A's unfairness prong granted the agency extensive powers to react to deficient privacy or security practices. That also was not upset here, and indeed, for good reason, I think, because that approach to security, to cybersecurity, was recently upheld by the Third Circuit in FTC against Wyndham Worldwide. So I leave it with a question for you. Is this the beginning of a decline in the FTC's privacy security jurisprudence? Or is it just a blip? I'm voting for the latter. It's a blip.
And I could completely see that point of view, Nick, and I defer to you. You have followed the twists and turns of FTC sharing jurisdiction over health data with HHS for longer and more expertly than I have. But I do say, just from as basic administrative law principles, when I look at, you know, the relationships between commissions and ALJs, as, you know, outlined in cases like Universal Camera and all of its progeny, you know, there's certainly ample room for there to be a reweighing of the evidence on the de novo review of the full commission when they look at this again. I, too, will be following LabMD, but my sort of weekly contribution for TWIL is going to be based on a post by Tim Jost on the Health Affair blogs called Administration Finalizes Regulations Implementing ACA Insurance Reforms. And Tim's posts are just amazing and highly recommended. And this one had two points that I think will be of great interest to the TWIL listenership. One is he commented on, first, growing coverage, including in a big New York Times article, on the role of deductibles and how deductibles were deterring people on exchange plans from using their insurance, then commented on a post by Kevin Counihan, the CEO of healthcare.gov, trying to emphasize that, all right, there might be sticker shock for many people when they see the initial deductible figure, but hold up, wait a second, for families with a certain levels of income, there are cost-sharing reductions, right, embedded into the Affordable Care Act. And I just had two responses to this. One is, as someone who teaches the Affordable Care Act, it does strike me again and again that it's just so hard to do education of the public in general, even of law students, with respect to how these complex interlocking subsidies of premium assistance tax credit and cost-sharing reductions work. Kudos to Tim and Kevin Counihan for bringing that up. The second is a problem of journalism. And, you know, Gary Schweitzer at the Health News Review talks a lot about problematic healthcare journalism. I'm noticing a trend at the New York Times where, for example, you'll have a story about, say, high deductibles, but then not enough sort of service journalism about what to do if you have those. Similar with some of their student loan coverage. They covered bizarre outlier high student loan debts, but never really talk about income-based repayment or the panoply of federal schemes meant to help individuals. So my little hope would be that the New York Times might take a look at its own service journalism record and think a bit about what would be the responsible complement to stories about, say, very high deductibles or other problems people face when there are clear federal programs related to them. The second point that I would make on the basis of Tim Jost's post is a more geeky administrative law point, which is that he observes on November 17th in Health Affairs that the Obama administration is converting many guidances related to the Affordable Care Act into final rules, and notes that that strategically is a wise move because essentially we could see a future administration be more hostile to the ACA and implementing regulations, and embedding them into legislative rules as opposed to guidances makes them a bit more robust against future revision. So I guess my question on the table, you know, given the controversy over the Affordable Care Act, are we going to see an evolution in administrative law in these areas with respect to less guidances, more legislative rules, at least with respect to the administrations that sort of believe deeply in the core ACA structures?
I'm just not convinced that we have an N that we can comment on yet, Frank, on that.
Agreed.
It looks interesting. We may see trends like that. We may see if the polls start turning in a particular direction, if we see a sudden increase in this in the run-up to the election, then maybe we can talk a little bit more about that. But I'm not sure I have a position. I would like to emphasize your prior statements about the Times piece. These pieces that come out seem to come out as criticisms based in cherry-picked statistics, but with very little emphasis on what can be done and maybe what is even being done, which I think was your point. I also think that some of these articles tend, as is often the case with the ACA, tend to have a single homogenized approach to the issue as though there was only one state in the union. Yet we know that there is considerable activity out in at least some of the states with regard to controlling or attempting to control through their insurance commissioners and so on some of those issues. But great issues they are. So I thought that some introduction to our guests' sort of presentation and discussion today was usefully to be drawn from a IMS health data survey that was published today. The data firm predicts that global spending, and I do stress global, not US, will increase by about 20% cumulatively from about $1 trillion now to about $1.3 trillion in 2020. That's drug spending. It's driven by expensive new drugs, price hikes, aging populations, and increased generic drug use in developing countries. The data also suggests that some large countries that are reforming their healthcare systems by increasing access are going to be drivers of this. But clearly, a large chunk of it is going to be U.S. Increased spending and costs. The second point I pull out of this IMS data is also referring to the state of things in 2020, but here specifically with regard to the United States. They estimate that about 90% of prescriptions dispensed in 2020 will be for generic medicines. That's up a couple of percentage points from now. So I don't think it's much of a surprise to the three of us or to any of our listeners that drug prices have been increasingly in the news, increasingly are being folded into various political narratives as the political campaigns gear up. And so I wondered, because you've been doing some really interesting work in these areas and looking at the different ways that intellectual property and markets operate with regard to different types of drugs, whether you could give us a really gentle introduction, Nicholson, into this area, in particular, lay the basis for a discussion of your article that you wrote with Artie Rye, by perhaps telling us a little bit about how small drugs and biologics and biosimilars tend to or work together to form sort of this broader drug market, and why it's important for us to sort of pull that apart and see what different IP rules and FDA rules apply.
Yeah, drug prices are becoming a bigger and bigger deal in the media, and it's not hard from some of the stats you pulled out to see why. So, for a long time, pretty much all the drugs, or at least most of the drugs that we focused on, were small molecule drugs that are typically pretty simple, and we can understand what they are chemically pretty well, even if we don't know exactly how they work. You know, things like aspirin and Advil and ibuprofen and everything that's pretty straightforward, pretty easy to make, pretty easy to understand. And now, on the other hand, there's a developing class. Pretty much all the new sexy giant drugs are part of this class, which is biologics, which are large molecule drugs that are largely protein-based. And so these drugs are things like Humira and Enbrel and a lot of the new cancer drugs. So I think currently 8 of the top 10 drugs by sales worldwide are biologics. And so the difference comes in what you were talking about, which is the transition to generics or kind of broader market competition. So for small molecule drugs, once a drug goes off patent, it's pretty easy to make copies of the drug. And because it's so easy to make copies of the drug, we tend to get a relatively large number of market entrants, generic firms who are interested in making small molecule molecule copies. And so prices drop quite rapidly, typically quite quickly. So you'll see prices dropping, 80 to 90% after you get more than just a few competitors into the market. Now, that's setting aside the issue of some of the rapid price increases we've seen in small molecule generics recently that I'm happy to chat about if that's of interest. But the story with biologics is different. Because they're so big and so complicated and so much more expensive to make, and because we understand less about them, what we tend to see, what we've tended to see so far, is much less entry of competitors kind of mimicking the role of generic competitors for small molecule drugs. In fact, it's so complicated and we understand it so well that we don't call competitors of kind of the innovator biologics generic biologics because we don't know enough to say that they're a copy. Instead, we call them biosimilars because they're pretty close. And that pretty close is a lot of the challenge in developing this kind of robust competitive market.
And I just wanted to make listeners aware that we will be linking to the Austin Fracht New York Times article and to your piece with Rye in the Iowa Law Review that I guess will be forthcoming pretty soon. Could you tell us a little bit more about your proposals in the piece and how that might lead to lower costs in that area?
Sure. So the challenge that we identify in particular and a little bit more specifically is, well, we've got this policy goal that we'd like to have competition and we'd like to have, you know, biosimilars doing the same sort of thing that generic small molecule drugs do, namely driving prices way down. But because we understand the science of biologics so much less well, and because they're manufactured in a way that's really complicated and really idiosyncratic, in fact, they're manufactured using living things like bacteria rather than using kind of chemical synthesis, the way you make the drug, the biologic, has a big impact on what the final product, or potentially big impact on what the final product is like. And it's really hard to figure out from the drug how to make it exactly the same. Basically, these things are so complex, we can't characterize them. And so it's hard to duplicate it without going through exactly the same process. But we argue, companies keep the process of making the drug as a trade secret, which means no one else can see what they did, and it's very hard to figure it out from reverse engineering. And so what that means is, you know, if for reasons of safety and efficacy and FDA approval, we say you have to come up with the exact same drug, and coming up with the exact same drug is something that's almost impossible without knowing how to make it, and that's secret, then we're not going to tend to see robust competition or market entry because companies just can't make the competitor, or at least not with a tremendous amount of expense, which kind of defeats the whole point. And so our suggestion flows relatively naturally from that, which is if the problem is a lack of information, we suggest that what we need is a regime that promotes disclosure. So FDA could say, when you need to get, or when you seek approval as a biologic, we need you to disclose how you actually make the biologic in a way that other competitors will eventually be able to use to make biosimilars and create robust competition. This is obviously relatively different from the traditional regime we have with manufacturing trade secrets, but we argue that it's substantially different here, and reasonably so, because of this underlying policy and public health goal, which is that we want robust competition for biologics, and we want to make sure that we're getting a safe and effective and a high-quality product. And for all that together, what we need is knowledge and transparency and not kind of this fundamental secrecy that characterizes the industry now.
Can I push you a little bit more on that, Nicholson? The providing these incentives that you talk about, how would they be structured? Because when I first looked at the article, I wondered whether you were sort of proposing a sort of patent light kind of system where the trade secrets are given up, or most of them, in exchange for something along the lines of exclusivity that we're used to in the patent world.
I mean, we already have a form of exclusivity for biologics. There already is a regime here. So just like for small molecule drugs, FDA won't let competitors take this abbreviated, fast, easy approval pathway that puts competitors into the market for several years after the initial drug is approved. We have the similar thing in biologics, where for 12 years after the initial approval of the biologic, FDA makes it hard, if not impossible, for putative competitors to use that abbreviated pathway to enter the market faster. That is, without putting in the hundreds of millions of dollars of clinical trials. So we've already got exclusivity for biologics. And so one version of this proposal is to say, well, if we really need a carrot, then the carrot can be extending that exclusivity by some period of time, by saying, you know, rather than having 12 years, we'll give you 12 and a half years or something like that. Now, it's important to recognize that this exclusivity tends to run in parallel with the patent exclusivity. So much of the time, there's not a new period of kind of exclusivity-based monopoly, but there are some benefits from having regulatory exclusivity, and in some cases, it would extend that period of market exclusivity.
So that really helps to clarify the matter, Nicholson. And at this point, I'd love to sort of open us out into a larger viewpoint on your work. And you've been publishing so many interesting things lately. I mean, from your perspective as both a researcher and a lawyer, or and I was just wondering in terms of where to start, one thing I wanted to draw a connection to was your points about the problems of disclosure with respect to the biologics, I think are very interestingly echoed in your recent articles about regulatory and patent law problems generated by predictive analytics and what you've called black box medicine. And I'm wondering if you could just describe to our listeners some of these cutting edge problems that are raised by, say, the use of predictive analytics or other forms of big data analysis when they are deployed in a medical context. And if you could also tie that to your concerns about how restrictions on patentability subject matter could unfairly or inauspiciously discourage the development of this black box medicine.
Right. So this is another area that I frankly just find incredibly exciting. For me, the fun part about writing and thinking in this area is that the science is just unbelievably cool. There's just all sorts of fascinating new stuff going on. The legal implications are interesting, and the science is cool, and it all gels together in a big pile of awesome, to my mind. So here, the issue that that I think is really exciting is what happens when we get huge amounts of data in health data, from all sorts of different sources, and then we combine that with really fancy computer algorithms that can find patterns that are hidden in the data. So the obvious analogy to this is something like Google image search, where you can, you know, say, show me pictures of ducks, and the algorithm can show you a bunch of pictures of ducks. Now, the weird thing about it is the algorithm doesn't know what a duck is and can't tell you what a duck is and can't tell you the rules that it uses to identify pictures of ducks, because the way it's trained is, you know, you just give it a giant data set and say, okay, well, here are a million pictures of ducks and here are a billion pictures of things that aren't ducks. You figure it out. And eventually the computer chugs and chugs and then figures out some sort of decision rule that it either can't tell you at all because the way that it trains is really fully opaque, or that maybe it could tell you, but it's so complicated that it doesn't make a difference because there's no way you could possibly understand it. And so this is an increasing set of algorithms, you know, predictive or descriptive or suggestive, and they're coming to medicine in ways like, you know, let me predict your risk, or let me classify your tumor into, you know, one group that responds to one drug or a different group that responds better to a different drug. And we just don't know what's going on, and we can't know what's going on. And so here's, I think, where I distinguish it from your work, Frank, because, you know, you talk a lot about, in tremendous work, on the black box society and what happens when we deliberately conceal the workings of the algorithms that govern our world. But this is a phenomenon that I think is somewhat different because it's about algorithms that govern our world that we can't disclose, even if we wanted to, because the ways we get them just don't scientifically allow that. And so it requires a different set, I think, of tools to think about it, particularly in the medical context, where we say, you know, we don't know what's going on and we can't know what's going on. How do we think about that? In some sense, it's a kind of an odd step back, right? Because, you know, earlier forms of medicine were based on hunches and guesses and personal experience of doctors and somebody looking at, you know, a radiology image and saying, well, that's a tumor. I can't tell you why, but it's a tumor and I know it. And over time, we've tried to move past that, and the evidence-based medicine paradigm and said, well, no, now we get what's going on, and we have the scientific method, and we use clinical trials, and we understand everything, and we're moving out of the darkness and into the light. And what I think is fascinating about black box medicine is it suggests that that moving out of the light might have been more of, as you said earlier in the podcast, a blip than a sustained trajectory. And that here what we have is, again, medicine based on tremendous numbers of well-validated hunches, but they're hunches that happen in the bowels of a computer system rather than in the gut of a doctor. So that's the general phenomenon. And the specific question that you raised is, well, what about patents? And the reason that we worry about patents here is because, you know, this is a phenomenon where you've got a bunch of information type expenses, gathering data, and developing algorithms, and trying to show that they're doing a good job. And those are all information goods, which are pretty easy to appropriate by somebody else. And so patents are the policy tool that we look to say, well, we would like you to invest in developing this new thing. We know it's easy for other people to copy it once you come out with it, so we'll give you a patent right and let you stop other people from copying it. But patents don't work pretty much at all for this. Can't get patents on data. And with respect to the algorithms, you know, the Supreme Court's recently said that this kind of stuff is going to be pretty typically unpatentable because it's laws of nature. It's fundamental facts about the world around us. That's what you're exploiting when you're finding these underlying medical relationships. So if you can't patent those, then how do we set the incentives and how do we help encourage innovators to, you know, push this area of medicine forward? And that's kind of what this project is trying to grapple with.
And it really does raise some fundamental epistemological issues, you know, in terms of like what we take as science and what we take as and how far will we be willing to take correlation versus causation and inquiring into the actual known causes or mechanisms versus, you know, relying on ever more sophisticated analytics engines. And I guess my one follow-up question, Nicholson, would be, from a big picture perspective, it seems as though whenever we shrink patent law, it's not as if innovators just give up, like other things expand. So, for example, trade secrecy might expand. And is your sense that essentially that the intellectual property strategy of a lot of firms in black box medicine might move from, say, a more disclosure-friendly patent regime to a trade secrecy regime, which would in turn impede sequential innovation because later innovators are not able to know the full range and body of work that's out there in order to build upon it?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. And that's exactly what I'm concerned with. Going back for just a quick moment to your point about correlation versus causation, you know, I totally agree. I think the epistemological questions here are fascinating ones, partly because they're fascinating on their own, and partly because they also help us uncover some aspects of the way we think about medicine right now. In that, you know, people that I talk to about this are often uncomfortable with the idea that we don't know what's going on and we want a scientific explanation, but we don't understand what's going on with a huge chunk of modern medicine anyway. There are still a bunch of drugs. We don't know how they work. There are still a bunch of treatments. They don't know how they work. We're doing a lot of guesswork in medicine. Not to impugn anything, but it's just the nature of medicine is that we don't know a lot of what's happening. So I think confronting an area where we can't know what's happening might help make us a little bit uncomfortable or at least inclined to rethink the way we think about things where we believe we know what's happening but really don't know that either. And some of these polite legal fictions about, you know, learned intermediaries and doctors knowing everything are legal fictions that I think continue to crumble. But on to your other point about trade secrecy, you know, I totally agree with this. And so what I think here is there's something of a natural inclination to say, A, this algorithm is inherently undisclosable because it's truly scientifically opaque, and so why would I disclose it? And B, if patents aren't available, why would I disclose anything about the algorithm, how I developed it, what the data were, how I made sure that it is high quality, when instead my competitive advantage can come from keeping that information secret. And this, I think, is, you know, exactly the problem, or at least a potential problem that I see here, which is, you know, as you say, sequential innovation depends on getting information out there into the field. That's kind of why we have a patent system in the first place. And you know, without the sharing of information, it's tough to make sure that things that are inherently black box are in fact high quality and do in fact work and can in fact support further innovation. And so one response might be to say, well, you know, if patents are designed to help facilitate disclosure, then maybe the answer is we should just change the patent system back and try to make sure that this stuff is easy to cover. The problem with that is, well, A, patents don't do a great job of facilitating disclosure on their own, and B, no, I think there's, I might get some flack from IP professors for this, but I think there's some sense to what the Supreme Court says in terms of, you know, when you're really talking about fundamental building blocks of innovation and technology and things about the way the world is, there's some sense to saying that's not the kind of thing we want the patent system to promote. And that leaves us with kind of a hole. What do we do to get this type of innovation to happen? What incentives can we set? And there, you know, I think the role is potentially one where the government can step in. An idea that I like in this area is information as infrastructure for innovation, where if a lot of the cost of developing black box algorithms comes from consolidating and curating and administering big sets of data to find the patterns, that might be a place where some centralization and some infrastructure thinking could end up being really helpful.
And with that gauntlet thrown down to any IP professors listening who'd like to come on and talk about the topic, that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A special thank you to Professor Price for joining us today. You can find him on Twitter at W. Nicholson Price, WNICHOLSONPRICE. Thank you for joining us, Nicholson.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
We post our show notes at twill.com, TWIHL.com. Also at twill.com, you'll see a link to our crowdfunding page if you'd like to support the show. Or, of course, given the holiday season coming up, buy our Twill t-shirts and exclaim your health geekiness. Also, please go to iTunes if you've got a moment and rate our show. You can contact me at Nicholas Terry on Twitter. Frank, where can you be found this week?
I am at Frank Pasquale on Twitter.
Thank you for joining us and have a legally interesting but healthy week.